And here is the Vegan's Almanac for today, the 19th of July. July 19th is National Urban Beekeeping Day. Many of us have heard that bees are declining, and some might think a solution is beekeeping. On the surface, this makes sense. It would seem that more bees in more places would help. But honeybees, native to Europe, Africa, and parts of Asia, are not at risk of extinction. In fact, it is estimated that there are more honeybees on the planet now than at any time in human history. In contrast, there are more than 3,600 bee species native to North America, some of which are facing the real risk of extinction. 28% of bumblebee species in North America are considered threatened, and more than 40% of invertebrate pollinator species, particularly bees and butterflies, may face extinction in the coming decades. Native bees co-evolved with our native plants and often have behavioral adaptations that make them better pollinators than honeybees. For example, buzz pollination, in which a bee grasps a flower and shakes the pollen loose, is a behavior at which bumblebees and other large-bodied native bees excel, and one that honeybees lack. Honeybees are known as nectar robbers, accessing their nectar in a way that means they don't touch the pollen, often by biting a hole in the base of the flower. By contrast, our native bees carry pollen all over their bodies, where it's more likely to pollinate plants. Hives increase competition with our native bees and raise the energy costs of foraging, which can be significant. Beekeeping is not bee conservation. Managed honeybees are domesticated livestock, and their very presence often harms native species. But there is something we can do to help our native pollinators. Creating pollinator habitat increases biodiversity, and such habitat can be situated anywhere, in backyards, on balconies and porches, on rooftops, in office landscapes, in local parks, and community gardens. It's the birthday of Brian May, born on this day in 1947. Brian May is best known as the guitarist for legendary rock band Queen. He's also an astrophysicist, though he abandoned his PhD after 2 years to pursue his musical career. In recent years, May has become heavily involved in the animal rights movement. He formed the campaign group Save Me, focusing on protecting wild animals, foxes and badgers, from persecution. Although May had been fighting for animals for years, he didn't actually go vegan until January 2020, when he took part in Veganuary as an experiment. May said, "We've seen more of the effects of how eating animals has brought us to our knees as a species. I think it's time to re-examine our world in a way that doesn't abuse other species." It's the birthday of Michael Clapper, born on this day in 1947. Michael Clapper, MD, is an American physician, author, and advocate for veganism and animal rights. Clapper grew up on a dairy farm in Wisconsin. He graduated from the University of Illinois College of Medicine in 1972. He has practiced medicine for over 50 years and is a leading educator in applied plant-based nutrition. His books include Vegan Nutrition, Pure and Simple, and Pregnancy, Children, and the Vegan Diet. He has appeared in several films related to vegan diet, including Eat This, Cowspiracy, The Sustainability Secret, and What the Health. It's the birthday of Victor Kosakowski, born on this day in 1961. When Victor Kosakowski was 4, his parents sent him from St. Petersburg to stay with his uncle's family in the countryside. It was a cold winter, he says, minus 30 degrees. Warmth came from the boy's friendship with a one-month-old piglet named Vaisa. They were inseparable until she became cutlets for New Year's Eve supper. When they ate her, "For me, it was a total disaster," says Kosakowski. "You killed my best friend," he screamed at his relatives. And so, he jokes, he became the Soviet Union's first vegetarian. Half a century later, Kosakowski went vegan as he began production of Gunda, a documentary starring a sow, a couple of aging cows, and a one-legged chicken. Gunda has no narration or soundtrack. Instead, we watch the animals simply exist. They feed, snuggle, care for their young, and scamper in fields. It turns out that no digital trickery or anthropomorphic narrative is needed for us to fall in love with them. Here's a poem for today, In Life's Garden by Dixie Wilson. Count your garden by the flowers, never by the leaves that fall. Count your days by golden hours, don't remember clouds at all. Count your nights by stars, not shadows. Count your life by smiles, not tears. And with joy through all your lifetime, count your age by friends, not years. In Life's Garden by Dixie Wilson. This has been the Vegan's Almanac with a reminder to count your animal friends. Welcome to Animalia Hour, a full hour of news and stories related to non-human animals, as well as the joyful and healthful benefits of plant-based eating. I am your host, Sarah Hale. Thank you for being here. Today we are reading chapter 3 of our book, Don't Drink Your Milk, Frightening Medical Facts About the World's Most Overrated Nutrient by Frank A. Oski, MD. Chapter 3, Don't Cry Over Spilled Milk. Brian Gordon was now 2.5 years old, and Mrs. Gordon had just about given up hope that he would ever be completely well. It all started around the age of 6 months when Brian began to have diarrhea. He soon became pale. Eventually, he developed swelling of his hands and feet, and his abdomen became bloated. Mrs. Gordon took Brian to several doctors in her small suburb. Many tests were performed, but no satisfactory answers resulted. Brian's diet was changed from one formula to another, but nothing seemed to help for any length of time. Brian was found to have iron deficiency anemia, but treatment with iron for months on end produced no improvement. In desperation, Mrs. Gordon took Brian to a large medical center in hopes that somebody might be able to figure out what was wrong with her son. In just 4 days, he was almost completely cured. Brian was found to be extremely sensitive to the protein in cow's milk. As soon as Brian's diet was changed to exclude all protein derived from cows, the swelling went away, his diarrhea stopped, and his blood count began to return to normal. Mrs. Gordon had tried Brian on a diet free from cow's milk in the past, but it hadn't worked. Brian was so sensitive to the cow's milk protein that all traces of it had to be removed from his diet. There had been cow's milk in the cookies Brian ate, in the custards he had for dessert, and in the beef he enjoyed several times a week. Although Brian's problems was extreme, allergy to cow's milk is far more common than is generally appreciated. Dr. Joyce Grabowski, former director of the Pediatric Gastrointestinal Clinic at Yale University School of Medicine, states that they see at least one child a week who is referred for evaluation of chronic diarrhea and proves to have nothing more than an allergy to cow's milk. This allergy may take many forms. Gastrointestinal disturbance is just one of the many ways that the allergy may make itself known. The most common form is believed by many to be chronic diarrhea. The stools range in consistency from several bothersome soft semi-form stools to numerous watery explosive stools. Mucus is frequent, and some stools contain obvious traces of bright red blood. The symptoms usually begin shortly after a child begins to take whole cow's milk, but may also be observed in children who drink commercial formulas that include cow's milk protein. Those with mild symptoms grow well, but those with severe diarrhea are retarded in their weight gain. The diarrhea impairs the infant's ability to retain nutrients from his feedings. In addition, the changes produced in the gastrointestinal tract by the allergic reaction result in seepage of the child's own blood into the gut. This loss of plasma and red cells leads to a lowering of the infant's blood protein level and to the development of anemia. The lowering of serum proteins, if profound, results in swelling of the abdomen, hands, and feet. Most infants with this condition respond promptly to the elimination of cow's milk from the diet. All symptoms may disappear within 2 days. Many of these infants may eventually develop the capacity to tolerate cow's milk, but this rarely occurs before the age of 2. In some instances, a child may be at least 5 years old before it is safe to feed him foods containing cow's milk protein. A less dramatic form of gastrointestinal sensitivity to cow's milk is also being recognized with increasing frequency. This form of sensitivity rarely produces dramatic symptoms, but results in slow and steady bleeding. Infants with this form of milk sensitivity may lose 1 to 5 milliliters of blood per day in their stool. Eventually, they become anemic from the steady hemorrhage. The volumes of blood lost each day are too small for detection by simple visual examination. The stools appear to be of normal color, and the blood can only be detected by chemical tests. It is estimated that half the iron deficiency in infants in the United States is primarily a result from this form of cow's milk-induced gastrointestinal bleeding. This is a staggering figure when one realizes that approximately 15 to 20% of all children under the age of 2 in this country suffer from iron deficiency anemia. In this condition, too, when cow's milk is removed from the diet, the bleeding ceases and treatment with iron medication corrects the anemia. If iron therapy is instituted while the child continues to drink cow's milk, the blood loss goes on and offsets the benefits normally derived from the iron-containing medication. The drinking of large quantities of cow's milk has long been recognized to produce iron deficiency anemia in infants. It has been assumed that the anemia was solely the result of the child not getting enough iron in his diet. Cow's milk contains less than 1 milligram of iron per quart. Very little of this iron is absorbed from the intestinal tract because other constituents of the milk bind the iron and make it difficult for it to be taken up from the bowel into the blood. It has been estimated that an infant of 1 year of age would have to drink 24 quarts of milk per day to meet his iron requirements. Many infants drink from 1 to 2 quarts of milk per day. This tends to satisfy their hunger, and they are left with very little appetite for the necessary iron-containing foods. It would now appear that the consumption of cow's milk by infants produces iron deficiency in 2 ways. It provides very little dietary iron and at the same time produces iron loss by inducing gastrointestinal bleeding. The resultant iron deficiency anemia makes a child irritable, apathetic, and inattentive. The infant cries a great deal, the mother gives a bottle of milk to soothe him, and the condition continues to get worse. The recognition that excessive milk intake is often associated with iron deficiency has led to the description of blue bottle syndrome. This syndrome is characterized by the toddler who is always walking around with a bottle in his hand. The bottle is filled with milk from which the child intermittently sucks. In the pre-plastic days, it was unusual to see children drinking from bottles much after the first year of life. The infant, once he was up and around, would start dropping bottles. The glass bottles would break, and after the infant broke a few bottles, the mother would generally decide that it was time for her child to begin drinking from a cup. Now that the indestructible plastic bottle is available, the economic pressure to institute cup drinking has been eliminated, and it is not uncommon to see 3 or even 4-year-olds with bottles. These milkaholics are usually iron deficient. Although plastic bottles do come in a variety of colors, the blue bottle appears to be the most popular among mothers and children, hence the term blue bottle syndrome. We have digressed from our theme of cow's milk protein and cow's milk allergy. Just how common is it, and what are the symptoms, in addition to those that involve the gastrointestinal tract? The incidence of allergy to cow's milk has been variously estimated to range from as low as 0.3% of infants to as high as 25%. Obviously, the criteria employed by physicians who make these diagnoses must be carefully examined in order to interpret their conclusions. A careful analysis of the problem of cow's milk allergy was performed by Dr. J.W. Girard and associates in Saskatoon, Canada. Dr. Girard and his colleagues personally supervised the care of 787 babies consecutively admitted to their practice in an attempt to determine the frequency of whole cow's milk allergies. Infants were followed from birth. No attempt was made to persuade a mother to select one formula rather than another. A record was kept of the ages at which new foods were offered to the babies for the first time. A baby with one or more of the following symptoms was considered a candidate for cow's milk allergies and then studied further. Number one, persistent or recurrent nasal congestion, attacks of asthma or chest infections. Number two, persistent or recurrent skin rash. Number three, vomiting or diarrhea, persistent or recurrent, for which no other explanation was present. When a baby was thought to have an allergy to whole cow's milk, he was taken off his cow's milk formula and offered a formula prepared from soybeans instead. If his symptoms disappeared, he was then again put on cow's milk. If his symptoms returned, he was again taken off milk and all other dairy products. When his symptoms subsided, he was again challenged with milk and dairy products. Only if his symptoms returned on a second occasion was he considered allergic to cow's milk. Of the 787 babies studied, 59 were found to be allergic to cow's milk, an overall incidence of 7.5%. Symptoms seen most frequently in babies who were identified as allergic to cow's milk included diarrhea, repeated vomiting, eczema, recurrent attacks of nasal congestion, and recurrent bronchitis. A careful review of the mother's diaries revealed that 25% of infants showed the first signs of their cow's milk allergy within 3 days of being given a formula derived from cow's milk, and that almost half the children showed signs of their allergic problems within 1 week of starting such feedings. The earlier in the child's life that he was fed cow's milk, the more likely he was to develop allergic symptoms. Although the overall incidence of allergy to cow's milk in children under 1 year of age was 7.5%, fully one in every four children who was given cow's milk before 3 months of age showed some signs of allergy. Children who were allergic to cow's milk saw their doctors much more frequently than the non-allergic children and required hospitalization on more occasions than the non-allergic children. Dr. Girard and his colleagues also noted that allergy to cow's milk was much more likely to develop in children whose parents or brothers and sisters had other allergic diseases. This was particularly true in the infants of parents who had had hay fever or asthma. It would appear from these studies that giving cow's milk to human infants can produce disease, and that the earlier the human infant is exposed to milk from another species, the more likely he is to show signs of intolerance. Studies of this type, as well as the evidence that cow's milk can produce gastrointestinal bleeding in young infants, lends further support to the old adage, cow's milk is for cows. Even more serious complications of cow's milk have been described by a group of investigators from the University of Colorado and the University of Miami Schools of Medicine. Working together, they identified a number of children 10 to 13 years old who had a troublesome form of persistent kidney disease known as nephrosis. Nephrosis is a disorder in which excess amounts of proteins are lost from a damaged kidney. This continued loss of protein into the urine produces a lowering of the blood protein level and eventually results in pronounced fluid accumulation in the child. Children may have swollen hands and feet as well as fluid in their abdomen. Some children may develop renal disease and die. Most children with nephrosis respond quite nicely to a variety of drugs. The drug that is most useful and derived from is derived from the adrenal gland and is a form of cortisone. But the children studied by the doctors in Colorado and Miami were patients who did not appear to benefit from cortisone. These physicians suspected that the children might be allergic to a variety of foods. Much to their surprise and gratification, they found that when milk was removed from the diet, these children promptly stopped losing protein in their urine and showed signs of marked improvement. When milk was added to the diets within 1 to 3 days, the urinary excretion of protein markedly increased. These investigators concluded that sensitivity to milk and other foods may play a major role in producing relapse in some children with nephrosis. Other physicians noted additional relationship between cow's milk and diseases in children. Dr. J. Dan Baggett, a pediatrician in Alabama, researched the harmful effects of cow's milk. Here are portions of a letter written by Dr. Baggett describing his experience. When I opened my practice here in Montgomery, Alabama in 1960, I was aware of a causal relationship between cow's milk protein in the diet and infantile eczema. I also knew that many of these eczematoid children became asthmatics later on unless their eczema could be cleared early by dietary manipulation. This prompted me to begin a system of dietary prophylaxis against allergic disease among the newborns in my care. Only strained foods containing no milk, wheat, egg, or citrus were allowed through age 9 months. When my babies developed eczema, they were promptly switched to a soy formula, and although most of these did well, a few of them would clear only to eventually develop eczema from the soy. Usually, there were further alternatives available, allowing me to raise them without eczema. Gradually, I became aware of the demonstrable relationship of food items in the causation of several respiratory and gastrointestinal disorders. In 1964, I learned from the experiences of Dr. William Deemer of San Francisco. He had pointed out the frequency of milk protein's causal relationship to musculoskeletal pain in children, and especially the so-called growing pains. Since that time, I have had several children with what appeared to be early rheumatoid arthritis, relieved and returned to good health by little more than reassurance and careful dietary manipulation. About 6 years ago, I began systematically persuading every patient of mine to delete all cow's milk products from their diets. In general, they cooperate much better than I had earlier anticipated, except for the pre-teenagers and teenagers. My patients are all given a list of legal breads, crackers, cakes, mixes, and cookies containing no casein, caseinate, whey, or milk solids. They are allowed small amounts of butter, contains 2% whey, and 100% corn oil margarine. Corn oil and safflower oil are recommended for cooking. They are, in addition, given a modification of Dr. W.L. Deemer's milk protein avoidance list to assist them in their shopping habits. During the years 1963 through 1967, I referred an average of 4 appendectomy cases per year. During the past 5.5 years, I referred only 2 patients for appendectomy, the last one being 3 years old. Both of these children were professed milk guzzlers. I do not have a single patient with active asthma. In fact, I have nearly forgotten how to prescribe for them. Perhaps the most significant thing I have learned is that group A beta hemolytic streptococcus germ will not, under ordinary circumstances, establish an infection in a child kept on an absolutely no milk protein dietary regimen. I have been aware of this for the past 2.5 years, and so far there have been no exceptions. Anytime a patient of mine is found to have streptococcal pharyngitis or Yoderma, We can establish by history that he has ingested milk protein within 5 days prior to onset of symptoms or signs bringing him to the office. I now admit an average of 12 to 14 patients per year to the hospital. Their average hospital stay is 3 days. Between 1963 and 1967, I admitted an average of 100 plus patients to the hospital per year. Their average hospital stay was 5 days. Breastfed is best fed, and cow's milk is the ideal food for the newly born and rapidly growing calf. My nursing mothers are advised to eat eggs if tolerated and dark green leafy vegetables and to take prenatal vitamins and bone meal tablets for an abundance of calcium. They're advised to eschew all cow's milk, protein, chocolate, cola drinks, peanuts, and raw onion, and to eat anything else they want that doesn't upset their nursing baby. Such a wonderful experience is in store for them when they do it right. The observation relating streptococcal disease to milk protein in the diet can be verified by most any pediatrician with time and patience to test it. It is often helpful to ask the child first whether he has had milk, ice cream, or cheese in his diet within the week prior to the office visit where strep is suspected. This cuts down on the embarrassment of having the child volunteer information contrary to the parent's story. As human beings, we show great variability in what we are able to tolerate and what we eat. For many of us, it is quite apparent that cow's milk will produce disease. Since the human infant was never supposed to drink cow's milk in the first place, it is not surprising that they appear most vulnerable. And since no animal drinks milk after it's weaned, it is not surprising that the drinking of cow's milk after 1 to 2 years of age will also produce disease. What is surprising is how frequently cow's milk produces disturbances and how long it has taken for the medical profession to recognize this factor. Allergies to Milk was published in 1980. The authors of this book, which is a comprehensive text and extensive catalog of what we presently know about this subject, are Sammy Bonna and Douglas Heiner. For the reader wishing to pursue the current scientific foundation for the immunologic basis of milk allergy, the book by Drs. Bonna and Heiner can be highly recommended. In the first chapter of the book, they begin with the following. Until recently, allergy to cow's milk was a controversial subject toward which many physicians had differing attitudes. Some textbooks of pediatrics either avoid mentioning cow's milk allergy or only lightly refer to its relation to gastrointestinal symptoms. A few clinicians do not believe the condition exists and thus are understandably reluctant to diagnose it. On the other hand, there are those, particularly among pediatricians and to a lesser extent among general practitioners, who overzealously label infants milk sensitive and who are inclined to recommend discontinuing the use of cow's milk whenever an infant has a gastrointestinal upset, respiratory symptoms, or a skin rash. Among the reasons for such divergent attitudes are 1, the variety of symptoms caused by cow's milk allergy, many of which may also occur as manifestations of other morbid conditions, and 2, the lack of a reliable single practical laboratory test. Public awareness of cow's milk allergy, though increasing, is still marginal. Parents frequently are incredulous that milk could cause the symptoms their infant is exhibiting. The prevailing attitude is that cow's milk is not only a desirable food, but the ideal food and an essential element of the child's diet. And that is the end of chapter 3 of Don't Drink Your Milk, Frightening Medical Facts About the World's Most Overrated Nutrient by Frank A. Oski, MD. We'll read chapter 4 next time. Philip Wolin is a prominent Australian philanthropist, environmentalist, and animal rights activist. He formerly served as the vice president of Citibank, but he famously left his highly successful corporate career to dedicate his life and personal fortune to funding hundreds of charitable projects across the globe through his foundation, the Kindness Trust. He gave a widely renowned, globally viral speech while accepting the prestigious Albert Schweitzer Award at the Last Chance for Animals Gala in 2017. And we're going to go ahead and listen as I read this speech that he gave at that gala event. I am profoundly grateful for this honor, and I humbly accept it, not for myself, but on behalf of all animal rights activists like Chris DeRose and others in this room. Animal rights activists like you are the bravest of all first responders because you confront a deeply entrenched status quo of vested interest, industry, politics, and culture. You are Lincoln's better angels of our nature, the beacon on the hill. And a day will dawn when civilization will owe you a debt of gratitude it can never repay. They say that behind every successful man, there is a very surprised woman. My debt of gratitude is to my beloved wife, Trix. Rudyard Kipling wrote of young men dying in World War I, and if they ask you why we died, tell them that our fathers lied. That legacy of lies continues today. Everything we think we know about the animal-industrial complex is a preposterous lie. The world is crying out for two things, leadership and the truth. Civilized people tell the truth. The wise Chinese have a word for it, Zhengyu. Listen to the friend who tells you the truth, even if it hurts. So let's just tell the truth, fearlessly and forcefully. That is what the Sanskrit word satyagraha means, the truth force. Brendan Kennelly in the Book of Judas wrote, if you want to serve your age, betray it. But what does it mean to betray your age? It means expose its lies, humiliate its conceits, debunk its arrogance, and condemn them to face harsher truths. Alvin Toffler said, the illiterate of the 21st century will not be those who cannot read and write, but those who cannot learn, unlearn, and relearn. I have long admired Count Moltke, the Prussian general, a soldier who preferred to think rather than speak, a man silent in seven languages. It takes courage to stand up and speak. It also takes courage to sit down and listen. So what made me decide to leave the world of lobsters and Learjets in exchange for shelters and slaughterhouses? To take nothing but pictures, to own nothing but memories, to leave nothing but footprints, to kill nothing but time. Something happened to me. I had been to Dante's Inferno, but unlike Dante Alighieri, I did not have Beatrice for my love, nor Virgil for my guide. I heard the screams of my dying father as his body was ravaged by the many cancers that killed him, and I realized I had heard those screams before. In the slaughterhouse, on the cattle ships to the Middle East, and the dying mother wail as a harpoon explodes in her brain as she calls out to her calf. Their cries were the cries of my father. They were identical. I discovered when we suffer as equals. And in their capacity to suffer, a dog is a pig, is a bear, is a boy. When I look into your beautiful faces tonight, I recall the words of the Greek poet Horace, change only the names, and my story is also about you. In human history, 100 billion people have ever lived. 7 billion are alive today. And we torture and kill 2 billion land animals every week and stab and suffocate 1 billion ocean animals every 8 hours. If humans were killed at the same rate, we'd be wiped out in a weekend. Trillions of fish are ground up into pellets to feed livestock. Vegetarian cows are now the world's largest ocean predators. The great astrophysicist Carl Sagan's picture from the Voyager spacecraft showed the tiniest microscopic pinhole of space. He described it as our pale blue dot suspended on a sunbeam. Well, human beings comprise 30% of the mass of land animals, slaughter farm animals 66%. Wild animals decimated down to 4%. We have turned the Carl Sagan's pale blue planet Earth into blood-stained planet slaughterhouse. The oceans are dying in our time. By 2048, all our fisheries will be dead, the lungs and the arteries of the Earth. If any of my algorithms are correct, it means no child under the age of 5 will ever reach retirement age. 10,000 entire species are wiped out every year because of the actions of one species. We now face the 6th mass extinction in cosmological history, and the meat industry is killing us too, with cancers, diabetes, and heart disease. It is deforesting the planet, poisoning the oceans, draining the rivers and aquifers, and bankrupting global economies. If any other organism did this, a biologist would call it a virus. It is a crime against humanity of unimaginable proportions. The anthropologist Margaret Mead said, "Never doubt that a few committed people can change the world. It is the only thing that ever has." There are only 13 million Jews in the world, but they play a vibrant role in international affairs. Look at the number of Nobel Prizes they win every year. Trix and I sat in the stadium at the Olympics full of pride as Australia, with a population less than Florida, won more medals than every other country in the world except the U.S. and Russia. Tibet's population is only 3 million, but who hasn't heard of the plight of the Tibetans? But there are over 600 million vegetarians and vegans in the world. That is bigger than the U.S., England, France, Germany, Spain, Italy, Canada, Australia, Israel combined. If they were one nation, they would be bigger than the 27 countries in the European Union. They are bigger than NATO. They are bigger than OPEC. Despite this massive footprint, they are still drowned out by the raucous, hunting, shooting, killing cartels who believe that violence is the answer, when it shouldn't even be a question. 1 billion people today are hungry. 20 million people will die from malnutrition. Cutting meat by only 10% will feed 100 million people. Going vegan ends malnutrition forever. Food prices are skyrocketing. Thai rice traded at USD 197 per ton. It went up to USD 1,015, a fivefold increase in 5 months. Poor countries sell their grain to the West for hard currency while their own children starve in their arms, and the West feeds it to livestock. So we can eat a steak? I bet I am not the only one in the room who sees this as a crime. Every morsel of meat we eat is slapping the tear-stained face of a starving child. When I look into her eyes, do I remain silent? If everyone ate a Western diet, we would need 2 planet Earths to feed them. We only have one, and she is dying. The Earth can produce enough for everyone's need, but not enough for everyone's greed. There are 2 peak predators on the planet, humans on land and orcas in the ocean. In the 20th century, humans killed 200 million members of their own species. Orcas killed none. Don't expect protection from governments either. In the 20th century, 100 million people were killed by their own governments. Victor Hugo said there is nothing more powerful than an idea whose time has come. But I say there is nothing more destructive than a bad idea whose time has passed. The time for meat has passed. Happily, the world is changing. 20 years ago, Twitter was a bird sound. WWW was a stuck keyboard. Cloud was in the sky. Skype was a typo. 3G was a parking place. Google was a baby's burp. And AI Kiter was my plumber. The most beautiful word ever written in any country, in any language, at any time in human history came from India in the Upanishads 3,000 years ago, ahimsa, nonviolence to all living beings. Not because it describes our nationality, our politics, our religion, our diet, or our lifestyle, but because it describes our character. It is a revolutionary event more powerful than the Industrial Revolution, the Reformation, the Hubble telescope, or anything conceived by Galileo, Copernicus, Einstein, Darwin, or Freud, because it protects the most precious of all things, life. People in this room are creating the new enlightenment, the second renaissance. We know the golden rule, do unto others as you would have them do unto you, from the New Testament of Jesus. But it goes back to the Babylonian Jew, Hillel, in 30 BCE. It actually goes back even further to the analytics of Confucius in 500 BCE. In fact, it was enshrined in human heart long before dawn of writing. Veganism is the Swiss Army knife of the future. One instrument solves our ethical, economic, environmental, water, health problems, and ends animal cruelty forever. I recently delivered speeches in the Senate, in The Hague, the Israel Knesset, Parliament in Jerusalem, and also addressed the World Parliament of Religions, and I said, veganism gives us the peace dividend. The peace map is drawn on a menu. Peace is not just the absence of war, it is the presence of justice. So talking of peace while killing animals is like loving literature and burning books. They are mutually exclusive ideas. In my journey through Joseph Conrad's Heart of Darkness, I have learned that a man is measured not by how much money he makes, but how much of it he is willing to give away, particularly to strangers. If you wish to increase a man's share of happiness, do not increase his possessions, simply decrease his desires. Socrates and Epicurus were right, an unexamined life is not worth living. You do not find your character on Wall Street, it lives on the road to Damascus. My heart resonates to the poet W.H. Auden, if equal affection cannot be, let the more loving one be me. Martin Niemöller, the German priest, philosopher, and U-boat captain, spent 8 years in prison for condemning German intellectuals for being cowards. When Nazis came for the communists, I remained silent. I was not a communist. When they locked up the Democrats, I remained silent. I was not a Democrat. When they came for the trade unionists, I did not speak out. I was not a trade unionist. When they came for the Jews, I remained silent. I was not a Jew. Then they came for me, and there was no one left to speak out. Men and women of integrity must speak out and act courageously. It is no better to light a candle. Is it not better to light a candle than curse the darkness? All the darkness in the world cannot put out the light of a single candle. I believe another day is dawning, and if I close my eyes, I can feel her heartbeat. Let's not relive history. Let's make history, because that is what leaders do. They make history. Judge White's closing words in The Bonfire of the Vanities were, "The law is humanity's attempt at decency." So I ask you to join the battle in the war that decency cannot afford to lose, because in the end, only three things matter: how deeply you loved, how gently you lived, and how gracefully you let go of things that were not meant for you. The brutes and bullies have been Goliath, but David is coming. Maybe he is in this room. Maybe he is one of you. If not you, who? If not now, when? I leave you with the words my mother read to me as a little boy. The same words I use each year when I launch the Sea Shepherd campaign against the Japanese whalers in Antarctica. Christopher Robin is reading to Winnie the Pooh. If ever there is a tomorrow when we're not together, there is something you must always remember. You are braver than you believe, stronger than you seem, and smarter than you think. But most importantly, even if we are apart, I will always be with you. And I know that this speech is available online. If you'd like to hear Philip Wollin read his own speech, I encourage you to do that. And here is a story published in Plant-Based News. UK Farming Roadmap calls on farmers to swap animals for lentils. The long-awaited farming roadmap lays out proposals for the next 25 years of UK food production, written by Liam Pritchett. The UK government has proposed supporting farmers to swap high-emitting animal agriculture for sustainable crops such as lentils. The Department for Environment, Food, and Rural Affairs, or the DEFRA, or DEFRA, published the Farming Roadmap 2050 at the end of June. The document aims to set out the government's long-term vision for agriculture in the UK. The new Farming Roadmap includes a provision to explore opportunities to diversify into lower emission farming systems where appropriate, and cited growing oil seeds and pulses such as sunflower seeds and pulses as an example. The roadmap noted that a transition away from animal products and towards sustainable, nutritious crops would coincide with growing demand for plant-based foods. Emma Reynolds, the Secretary of State for Environment, Food, and Rural Affairs, and Stephen Morgan, the Minister of State for Food Security and Rural Affairs, described the roadmap as reflective of the most pressing challenges and opportunities ahead. In a statement on the roadmap, they wrote, "Our ambition is straightforward: profitable farms that maintain domestic food production, fair rewards for the farmers who produce that food, good jobs in farming with clear career paths into farming, and a sector that helps restore nature and meet our climate goals while contributing to the growth of the British economy." The Farming Roadmap 2050 also notably mentioned methane-suppressing feed products and other agricultural decarbonization technologies. While reducing methane emissions could theoretically help to shrink animal farming's overall footprint, the industry would remain extremely resource-intensive, expensive, and inefficient. It would also continue to negatively impact wildlife, human health, and farmed animals themselves, and would make things harder for farmers, not easier. The roadmap has received pushback from the NFU and farmers due to the lack of clarity over delivery and the total absence of new funding to back up its proposals. Sustain, an alliance for better food and farming, praised the roadmap's clear long-term direction, but also noted gaps related to delivery. Sustain also highlighted recent contrasting proposals to weaken planning permission for poultry mega farms and the minimal rhetoric on rising livestock numbers as areas of concern. Alice Bannister, Sustainable Farming Campaign Manager at Sustain, called for clarity on how that vision will be delivered in practice. Doug Parr, Chief Scientist at Greenpeace UK, responded with similar points. He described the roadmap as very welcome, but added, "It's time for a radical shift back towards farming that works with nature and actually reaps the benefits from it. Many farmers are already showing that's possible. Others are more than ready for it, but all need proper funding and support from the government to make nature-friendly farming the norm." Also in June, a cross-party event saw farmers from across the EU call on policymakers to offer more support to those diversifying their protein production. In particular, they called for more support for the farmers already attempting to transition towards plant-based proteins and other ingredients. And from Sentient Media, here's a story titled, "Picture This Pig: Diners Shift from Selecting Meat on the Menu." A new study finds that adding animal images to menus increases the odds of choosing the vegetarian dish by 22%. And this article was written by Seth Milstein. If you want people to eat less pork, show them a picture of a pig. That's what a new study conducted in the UK suggests. The odds of university students, staff, and visitors choosing vegetarian dishes at the cafeteria were 22% higher when the menu listed a meat dish alongside a picture of the animal associated with it, the study finds. It's an example of how a barely perceptible intervention or a nudge can be used to encourage a choice, and in this case, promote dietary change. Global meat consumption has doubled over the last 60 years, despite the global call to eat less meat to mitigate the environmental harm caused by the meat industry. Animal agriculture is the biggest driver of deforestation and contributes up to 20% of all greenhouse gas emissions. But inspiring omnivores to cut down on meat has been an ongoing challenge. Scientists have coined the phrase the meat paradox to describe this issue. Many people will say they care about the well-being of animals, but then turn around and eat meat, supporting an industry known for its inhumane treatment of animals. And they will often point to cultural values to justify their diet. One way to redirect a person's thinking back to their empathy is to use what's called a nudge, a subtle change in design or presentation that may alter people's decisions without affecting their freedom to choose. In the 2008 book of the same name, authors Richard Thaler and Cass Sunstein defined a nudge as any aspect of the choice architecture that alters people's behavior in a predictable way without forbidding any options or significantly changing their economic incentives. To count as a mere nudge, the intervention must be easy and cheap to avoid, the authors wrote. Nudges are not mandates. Putting fruit at eye level counts as a nudge. Banning junk food does not. A nudge was the tool used in the UK study. Students, staff, and visitors in a university cafeteria were given one of two menus, one that was text only, or one that displayed images of living animals next to their corresponding meat dishes. The researchers observed dining patterns over 2 6-day periods. They found that when people looked at menus with pictures of animals, their odds of ordering a vegetarian dish jumped by 22%. These findings were consistent across the various pork, beef, chicken, and fish dishes included in the study, the researchers wrote. The students still had complete freedom to choose their meals. There was no incentive to pick the vegetarian option. This demonstrates that visual reminders of meat's animal origins can influence actual food choices in a natural setting, the researchers wrote. It's not the first study to support using nudges as a tool for encouraging eating more plant-based foods. A 2019 study found that when conference attendees were offered a meat buffet by default, with the option of switching to a plant-based dish, 94% chose the meat meal. But when a plant-based buffet was offered as the default, only 13% chose a meat dish. For years, organizations like Greener by Default and the Better Food Foundation have been helping places like hospitals and universities implement plant-based nudges at their cafeterias. This takes many forms, such as offering plant-based dishes by default, displaying them more prominently, and giving them more appetizing names. New York City's public hospitals deployed some of these policies, and after making subtle changes to how patients were offered food, the number of meat dishes served by the hospital fell by about 50%. The Better Food Foundation says that the various plant-based nudge initiatives it's helped implement have collectively reduced carbon emissions by 7.9 million kilograms annually. Many people are deeply attached to their food, and it's not surprising that many don't want to be told to eat less of something they love. This study adds to the growing body of evidence that nudges can be a powerful and effective way of encouraging people to choose to eat less meat. How this Atlanta Braves player accidentally became vegan and why he isn't looking back. Atlanta Braves pitcher Spencer Strider says switching to a vegan diet during his recovery from Tommy John surgery helped improve his health and shaped his views on eating for the planet. This story was written by Charlotte Poynting and was published in Veg News. Ulnar collateral ligament, or the UCL, reconstruction surgery is common in baseball players. In fact, the procedure is even nicknamed Tommy John surgery, after the MLB pitcher who was the first to have it back in the 1970s. So when Atlanta Braves pitcher Spencer Strider had to have the surgery back in 2019, he wasn't surprised, but he did take the rest and recovery as an opportunity to overhaul certain parts of his life. He decided to try a vegan diet and was impressed by the benefits. I had blood pressure that I was medicated for, which I always thought was a little peculiar for a 20-year-old. I had issues sleeping, he told The Guardian. He added, I decided one day to try it, and within 2 weeks, I was off the hypertension medicine. Strider isn't alone. Many athletes, including baseball players, have chosen to switch to a plant-based diet for health reasons. Back in 2018, New York Yankees pitcher CeCe Sabathia said that following a raw vegan diet helped him keep up with the younger players on the pitch. "I know if I can stay healthy and stay on the field, I could put up the numbers and good things will happen," he said at the time. In 2022, Leones de Yucatan pitcher Ryan Sheriff told Forks Over Knives that following a plant-based diet made him feel stronger than ever. "My strength is through the roof now, and I can last forever in my workouts," he said. "My recovery is great, but the biggest takeaway for me is that my mood changed." The bigger picture. For Strider, though, being vegan is about more than diet. "I think factory farming is certainly problematic and not exactly what we're supposed to be doing to the planet," he said. "Indeed, research suggests that factory farming, a system of intensive industrialized animal agriculture, is a leading source of greenhouse gas emissions, deforestation, and water pollution." In 2022, research from the University of Bonn in Germany suggested that meat consumption must drop by 75% in wealthier countries to meet global climate goals. Strider is pragmatic in his approach to encouraging others to reduce their animal intake. "I'm very conscious to the idea that any improvement, while it may seem insignificant, is still worthwhile," he continued. "For me, it's easier to be fully plant-based, but I think everybody can have a marginal improvement around the ethics of the meat industry that would collectively be great for the environment and the planet." We hope you enjoyed today's installment of Animalia Hour with me, Sarah Hale. We'll be back next week with more news and stories. Wishing you a gorgeous day. Bye.